From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last month when the White House rolled out Made in America Week. President Trump highlighted a number of products and companies that are producing in the United States, and the president touted the value of the Made in America slogan, saying it's all about American jobs. Set aside, of course, that the president has had most of his own companies produce products overseas, same with his daughter Ivanka. We know that. That's not the point this hour. Our attention turns to a piece written by conservative author Kevin Williamson in National Review Online. Williamson's piece was titled, "Buy American Has Little Meaning in Today's World of Globalized Supply Chains." In the piece, Williamson writes the following, quote, "In some ways, it hardly makes any sense to label almost anything made in the USA or made in any other place. Real life in the 21st century economy is a great deal more complicated than anything that can be captured on a label. The Michigan-based watchmaker Shinola was informed by the Federal Trade Commission last year that it could no longer describe its watches as American-made. Shinola watches are American-made, but they are made in America by inserting Swiss-made watch movements into cases made in any number of other places. Isn't that made in the USA? In a sense, sure. Also, in a sense, not. About 80% of what goes into a Toyota Camry sold in the United States is made in the United States, which is a lot more than some American, quote, cars. About 70% of a 2011 Honda Civic was American-made, while only about 2% of a Chevy Aveo from the same year was of North American origin." End quote. And that's just for starters. In fact, Williamson goes on to warn against an obsession with buying local or even buying national. That would be akin to, and here's a term that I don't think I've seen much more in passing, autarky? Someone's going to correct me on that in just a moment here. But it matters here. We're going to talk about the implications of all of this stuff with Kent Gardner, the chief economist with the Center for Governmental Research. Autarky, is that, what's the term? What is
no,
that?
That's, I'm familiar with it, but I'm not up for my Merriam-Webster definition of it. Right?
Well, bottom line is it goes to the idea, though, that if you really bought hyper-local all the time, that there could be consequences that we don't like, which we'll talk about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Here,
so. Okay. That's right.
Also here is Scott Bartkowski, who is the president of Refractron. Now, did I pronounce that correctly?
That is correct.
I'm on the money today. Well, Scott, why don't you tell us real briefly about what Refractron is?
Refractron Technology is a Newark-based manufacturing company. We manufacture a variety of ceramic components for many industrial applications, including wastewater, mining, can making, water jet parts, variety of others as well.
Adam Crandall is Manager of International Sales and Strategic Partners for Refractron. Welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Evan. Thanks for having me on.
Kent, I guess let's just back up and start with the whole Made in America thing that that the White House rolled out. They're not the first White House, and it's not a Republican-Democrat thing. Political leaders of all sides like to try to capitalize on the idea of buying American. But do you agree with Kevin Williamson that it does not mean what it used to?
I think that's a fair statement. I think that the examples that he rolls out are quite appropriate. We've got a global supply chain. I think most American manufacturers are taking advantage of a global supply chain. Those of us who believe at the end of the day that free trade actually yields higher income for the individuals who participate. We see this movement towards protectionism as negative. That said, there is a notion called mercantilism that says that we're going to sell to you, but we're going to buy as little as possible. So I believe it is true that if the United States were to sell to lots of other countries and buy as little as possible from those other countries, it would be possible for the United States to gain more from trade than we get by even trade. So unfair trade, so long as it's the scales are tilted in your direction, is better for you. In aggregate, I believe that a free trade system leads to higher incomes for everybody involved.
In a moment, I think Scott and Adam will kind of give us their own view on how their company is part of the global supply chain and how all of these things do kind of stitch together. But I also want to ask Kent a little bit more about what Williamson wrote. In his piece, he wrote, quote, "One of the great enduring stupidities of modern economic life is the belief that buying American is somehow beneficial to the United States as a whole. A related daft notion, very popular among our progressive friends, horrified at the chauvinism of Buy American campaigns is that buying local helps your local community and economy. This stuff has been studied and studied and studied, and the short version is that Buy American, Buy Local efforts amount to approximately squat.
He doesn't pull punches,
no.
Does he? Well, and again, as I said, you know, so long as you can manage to gain more from trade than you lose, it's possible that buying local can actually make you better off. The problem with that model is that it's a short-term gain. So if you think about this from a global perspective, if we all decided in the United States that we were only going to buy from the United States firms, the response of the rest of the world would be to say, fine, we're not going to buy anything from you. We'll buy from you. You buy from yourselves. We'll buy from ourselves. And eventually we'll all be purchasing a pineapple that has been grown in hothouses in Alabama. And I'm sure we'd be better off and we'd have great, you know, much cheaper pineapples if we were to buy them from hothouses grown in Alabama instead of buying them from the Central America where they grow a little more easily without quite so much energy. So, I mean, at the end of the day, buy local, and whether we're talking local or we're talking national, eventually it all falls apart. So the question I always ask about any public policy is this a policy that everyone can apply? If you scale it up and everyone follows the same rules, what are the consequences? And I think in terms of global trade, I think we kind of understand when we think about it in those terms that it's really self-destructive.
All right. So for our listeners who are maybe a little more suspicious of globalization, as there have been plenty of conversations, particularly right now on the American left, the question is, what's the direction to take it forward here? And are we going to respond to workers who feel that globalization has cost them? Are you hearing what Kent Gardner, chief economist at CGR, is saying? And are you thinking, wait a second, I don't see those benefits? You can join the program if you like, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. One more question for Kent before I turn to the guys from Refractron, which is this. The extreme example that Williamson brings up are countries that enforce buying local to the exclusion, not just a good idea promotional campaign, but he points to North Korea. And he says, how do you like that economy? He says Venezuela used to be a rich country, and they became really inward-looking, super protectionist, and so insulated that it was buy local, buy national only, and that led to a great regression in terms of their prosperity. So those are the extreme examples. I don't think we're going there as a country, but his point is that's what happens if you really do only buy local.
Well, I think picking apart North Korea and Venezuela there's a lot more wrong there than a policy around trade. I'm not sure that I quite buy his
example. It's a big cake of wrong. It's like the frosting is the trade.
Very big cake. That's right. Yeah. Very gooey, sloppy, messy cake. But I think it's difficult actually, in that context. But there are other countries, I suppose, you could point to where, ultimately the notion of buying exclusively locally or exclusively nationally, may reduce total well-being. But the trade conversation is very complicated. And again, in specific instances, we can benefit ourselves by restricting purchasing to a local community. Sometimes we can benefit our states by doing so. But again, if you're playing the long game for our nation, the long game, I think, for our state and for our region is to embrace trade and look for ways to be competitive with the global economy.
Are you personally swayed by any product that carries a Made in America label?
Not a bit.
Okay, let's turn back to the other side of the table. Scott Bartkowski and Adam Crandall are here from Refractron Technologies, which is in Wayne County. And again, how big of a company, Adam, now?
Yeah, so we've been around for 30-plus years, Evan. We're about 85 employees. And again, in the business of making advanced technical ceramics. We are local jobs in Newark, New York, and have a pretty strong presence in the local community.
And when you say ceramic something or other, I mean, let's help people see exactly what you're talking about. Your products might, or what you contribute to a product line might show up where?
Exactly. So when I say ceramics, I'm speaking of advanced technical ceramics. And when I say that, we're not talking pottery and art ceramics.
That's exactly what I thought. Thank you.
Exactly. So our ceramics are used in various applications in various industries, actually, throughout North America, within the United States, and also globally. So you can find them whether it's a diffuser or a filter in the drinking water, wastewater industry, all the way to the can tooling industry to make a soda can shape, and various other industries such as wire processing, air filtration, emissions plants of various types of different industries and products.
Okay. And so, Scott, you guys seem to be kind of the exactly the example that Williamson is talking about, that so much of what is produced in the world today is a global supply chain, that it is very hard to really narrow anything down to just being made in one single place. Do you agree with that?
Totally agree. Quite honestly, if we were forced to buy everything local, buy everything even in the United States, several of our product lines probably wouldn't exist. We find good quality that's not in the U.S. and also better pricing from other countries. So definitely be a challenge for us to exist without going global.
And Scott, that statement alone elicits some knee-jerk claim among some in the audience that, well, that's not a patriotic position to have. You know, I mean, you must do everything you can locally. And what you're talking about is just the survivability of a company. But what do you say to people who hear that and they think, well, that's not supportive enough of our own economy here?
Well, I think it's very supportive of our own economy. We actually employ, as Adam said, up to 85 people. Again, that's supporting the local economy for sure. And again, if those people didn't have Refractron to come to work to, I'm not sure where they would go, but certainly we are supporting the local economy.
Yeah, Adam, you're nodding there. I mean, this is the old debate that says if you want to be a purist, you can employ zero people. If you want to sort of be open to global trade, you can employ 85 at Refractron. Mm-hmm. And yes, some of the products that you're involved with has relationships in other places and other countries.
Exactly.
But we accept that and we want those 85 jobs and not zero. Is that how you view it?
Yeah, exactly, Evan. So again, as Scott mentioned, 85 current workers right now in our facility, they are contributing to the local economy. Those dollars that they're receiving in their paychecks weekly are going into our local economy to, you know, for a variety of different reasons, whether it's improving infrastructure, whether it's purchasing from small businesses. Yet at the same time, like Scott mentioned, we are also impacting at a global scale a variety of different industries throughout all kinds of different countries throughout the world. It's a major impact that we see we're making in the local economy, yet at the same time, other countries and other industries are benefiting from what these local workers are actually making on a day-to-day basis. So there can be an argument there for sure, but again, from what we're seeing on Refractron standpoint, from a business standpoint, we are seeing some significant benefits in our local community.
All right, so before I grab a phone call, Keith, hang there, and again, listeners, you want to jump in, especially as we talk about what trade and what globalization has done to this conversation about made in America or buying American with our guests. I just want to ask Kent Gardner, I want to go back to that question on, you know, Scott's making the point that they employ 85 people. And if you wanted to be a purist and say you can't get involved in anything that's not made locally, they may employ zero people. But the rejoinder to that tends to be that is too much capitulation, that we are losing so much on trade and that we haven't enforced standards, or at least that we haven't been tough enough on trade deals around the country, that maybe we do need to get more protectionist. So what do you think?
You know, again, the difficulty is that you could be more protectionist, and for a period of time, you can extract more from other countries. We talk, and economists talk about the gains from trade, that, you know, there's a certain benefit of putting together two countries that have different allocations of goods and services. You've got a high skill in this and a low skill in that. You've got a resource abundance in one kind of resource, a resource scarcity in the other. And when you put the two countries together, everyone can be better off. But the question is who gains how much from that relationship? And if you've got a big muscular relationship, you can extract more of the gains from trade. You know, I think about this in the context of President Trump. I mean, he has been in the real estate business historically. And in the real estate business, it's essentially a zero-sum game. Real estate, you get into a deal, and there's only a certain amount of benefit to go around. And the question is how much of that fixed benefit do I get as opposed to how much of the fixed benefit do you get? But with trade, there is more of a benefit from working together than it is, you know, working individually. And that's why we trade. And so if you do want to be muscular about it, if the, you know, the at this point, the United States is the most stable and the fastest growing of the Western economies. And so we're in a position actually to extract better deals. So if President Trump wants to extract a better deal from the European Union or from Canada or Mexico, we're probably in a position to extract a better deal now. But that's this round. What happens in 10 years when perhaps the United States isn't in such a favored position and we're renegotiating those terms? You know, we may lose out. So eventually, and that's cold comfort for people who have lost their jobs due to globalization. But over time, global trade benefits everybody in aggregate. But it doesn't benefit everyone individually. So there are still people who lose out because of global trade. But I still say, if you look at the history of trade, that in aggregate, the United States benefits, the United States individually benefits.
The president did say during the campaign, you know, he rattled sabers about a 35-40% tariff. He looked at Mexico. He was talked really tough about that. We haven't really seen that yet. Do you suspect that that was a lot of campaign rhetoric, or do you think that he's moving earnestly towards more of that attempt to extract, quote unquote, better deals?
You know, I think it depends on the day.
It sort of does, yeah.
So I don't really know.
Okay. That's a succinct answer and a fair one. Keith, first on the phones. Go ahead, Keith.
I have an interesting show. Dr. Gardner, your comment about that you don't particularly look for something made in America. I don't either, but except when it comes to food. If it's a packaged food item, I like to know where it's made. Because I just trust Americans' food packaging standards better than some foreign countries. And the other thing that I'm an old person. One thing else I've learned, sometimes cheap isn't always the best. I try to look for value. And I buy a lot of clothing at a department store at EC Mall that normally the prices are a little higher. But when you go in there and you're looking around, somebody will come up to you and say, can I help you? So if you need help, there's a human being there. If you need alterations, there's a human being that will do it. If you need it shipped, if you have to return it because something was defective, it's hard to put a price on that, but all that does get built into the sale price. But there's this one particular line of clothing that I sort of gravitate to, and it's all made in Canada, which is I just thought was sort of unusual because I think most of us are used to foreign-made clothing.
Okay. Thoughts on there?
So Keith, I think, I think we've got a long tradition in economics about what we call caveat emptor, which is buyer beware. And I completely agree with you. The quality differences matter, and quality influences our food products and the additives that go into food products. And I think we've got a wide open market in the United States to look for those products that satisfy our own particular interests and needs. And, you know, I just would object to someone telling me that I can't buy something. I'd much rather be empowered to buy something. And that's where labeling considerations come from. I think we want to know where stuff came from. We want to know something about what's in it. And we'd like to think that the federal government is at least, you know, from a food safety perspective, for example, looking out for our best interests. But I think we want consumers to make those decisions. I don't think we want to say you may not buy from Mexico. You may not buy from China.
One other thing, I think it's Patagonia, the clothing line of which I own absolutely no clothes from there. I think the guy who started it, he has a saying that poor people can't afford to buy cheap goods or something similar to that.
It's a nice slogan.
In a way, it does make sense. Now, I don't know if it is really him, but it does make sense.
Well, Keith, thank you. And I will just say to our listeners here, we have a pile of comments that have come in. I just asked on social media platforms if the slogan Made in America matters to you. Scott, does it matter to you? Are you more likely to buy something that says Made in America?
I think in general, I would say probably not. But I do agree with the caller on the food items especially. I do feel better when I buy something that's been at least made and purchased or packaged in the U.S. So
I tend to think that food is a little bit different though not entirely. I think it gets oversimplified and misunderstood at times, but I think food, I separate food a little bit in this conversation. But the idea of Made in America doesn't appeal as much to you. I wonder if that's because you're the CEO of a company that's involved in the global supply chain.
I think that has something to do with it for sure.
Okay, how do you feel?
I think Made in America is definitely important, Evan. Like I said, from a local job standpoint, that's what really is my concern, is continuing to support local jobs in the local community, bringing back investment to Rochester. But as well as a young millennial, myself being 29 years old, I've traveled globally. I've been exposed to more of an international type platform. So again, what Kent mentioned is free trade and increasing trade globally is really important, I think, that we need to continue to look at and promote. One interesting thing from this caller, actually, from the food standpoint that he brought up, Refractron makes a lot of food processing parts that American workers actually do manufacture here locally. So from a standard standpoint in other countries, maybe to make sure that the food quality is high and safe, I can understand that. But kind of interesting, because our workers every single day are actually manufacturing parts that go into the food and beverage and food processing industry. A lot of your local microbreweries use these parts, and they are of extreme high quality. So a lot of these consumers in Rochester may not even know it, but there's products coming in from around the world that may be food products that are actually touched by some of Refractron's products that are being exported every day.
Scott, there's a question from a listener named Trish who just wanted to kind of get your view as the CEO in terms of what a goal is in a company that's part of the global supply chain. She says, can you ask Scott if global trade is fair trade, i.e. that everyone involved in the chain is compensated fairly, and is that a goal?
It's certainly a goal. I think Kent, I totally agree with what Kent has been mentioning here as far as trade being fair for everyone. It's certainly our goal to make sure that everyone is it's treated fairly and treated well in the chain. Yes, definitely.
Yeah, and I think maybe what Trish is getting at is, you know, do you feel any sort of responsibility as part of that chain, because your workers are going to be treated probably differently than companies in different countries who might be part of the same chain? And I understand Trish's question. I don't know that it's fair is not the right word, but I, you know, it sounds like your first priority you feel is to your 85 employees and what you're doing here.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I guess if that's where you're going with it, yes, for sure, our employees are the most important. Yeah, we definitely want to make sure that we have a good place to work, treat them fairly, treat them well. We definitely care about what's going on inside our factory.
Yeah, so I don't want to read too much into Trish's comment, but I think she's sort of wondering, Kent, you know, are there companies and should we be in a position where we say, well, we may be part of this chain and we may treat our workers well, but we can't be part of the chain if it's part of a system that is maybe corrupt or problematic.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of evidence that says that America's involvement with global trade has raised labor standards all around the world. Now, there are some cases in which American companies have been deeply embarrassed by discovering that they're buying from manufacturers who that use child labor, where they have unsafe working conditions. And a lot of and American consumers have played a role in forcing those companies to enforce higher standards at their individual firms. So I think that that's the other issue that troubles me about this whole Buy America thing, is that by saying that, I think we're making starting with the presumption that Americans are more important than people who live in other countries. And, you know, if we're going to decide we're not going to buy from Sri Lanka or from Vietnam, you know, there are consequences for those people who lose their jobs in those other countries. And we have certainly seen a tremendous increase in global health and global income over the last 25 years as the world has become more integrated. I mean, the number of people who have been pulled out of extreme poverty over the last 20 years is astonishing, and particularly in China, of course. But there are benefits for people who live other places, and I guess I can't quite buy the notion that Americans should matter more.
Yeah, we've had a number of comments to that effect already here, just as a see if I can wade through them enough to get an example here. Nick says, Made in America on the label means nothing to me. I'm literally not at all more likely to buy it. Other people besides Americans have to eat too. And that's just one example of quite a few. Tim, David, John, on the phones, let's get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back to your phone calls as we discuss what Made in America means and the global supply chain and how it works. Kent Gardner is the chief economist with the Center for Governmental Research in Rochester. Scott Bartkowski is president of Refractron Technologies in Wayne County. Adam Crandall is their manager of international sales and strategic partners. And we'll get back to your phone calls right after our only break of the hour on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, the Gateways Music Festival is coming back, and their artistic director is joining us. Lee Koontz joins us in studio. He has his own fascinating path in music, from what music was to him growing up to how he has seen music serve as a tool to make communities stronger, to help kids in different populations, to help young adults. We'll talk with Lee about Gateways and more next hour. All right, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Before those phone calls, an important distinction was brought up just during our brief break here. Kent Gardner was raising it on this idea that when you have a global supply chain, and certainly Refractron is part of that, that may be part in Wayne County and maybe companies in other countries and other parts of the United States, that maybe there is some feeling that, well, if a local company that treats its workers well, but it's part of a chain and there's an awareness that workers in other parts of the chain are not treated well, is there a responsibility on a company to lean on those? And Kent kind of brought up the idea of leverage here. Why don't you tell us more about that?
Right. I think if you are 75% or 80% of a company's business, or you're just a very, very large customer, your Nike, for example, then as Nike or as Walmart, you have tremendous influence over those suppliers. If you're a company like Refractron, on the other hand, and you're buying a relatively small amount from a lot of global suppliers, your ability to lean on them is probably pretty limited.
Lean on them for standards.
For standards, that's right.
Yeah.
And so yes, you're part of the global supply chain and you have relatively little influence over it. But the one other thing is, it's not just American companies' ability to lean on other countries for labor standards, but it's also actually providing employment. And we do have to ask the question, in the absence of American demand for goods and services, would those workers in fact have a job at all?
Okay. Scott, you feel like that sums it up pretty well?
That actually says it very well.
That's a great statement.
I mean, we are definitely a small player in these with these vendors, so obviously our leverage is obviously very limited.
Okay, and just a definitional help from Professor Wes Renfro out at St. John Fisher College. He writes to say, Evan, just so you know, autarky is an economic philosophy that stresses total self-reliance, i.e. a nation that produces all the things it needs and it does not trade at all. No state follows this philosophy, but North Korea is as close as it gets right now. So maybe, yeah.
That's helpful.
The bad frosting on a bad cake. let's go back to your phone calls. Tim in Pittsford next. Go ahead, Tim.
Hey, Evan, I would like, if I could see on a tag, to see assembled at a factory in America from particularly a union shop. Now, you can't put that all on one tag, but I want the best parts. Say a product takes five different parts to make. I'd want them, the five best parts, whether they come from all over the world or not, is fine with me, but I would like them assembled in America if we could have that. That means people in America have a job. All these factory jobs they talk about that are not quite existent anymore, but that would mean employment for people, for your neighbors. And what Kent was saying about not wanting people in other countries to have these jobs, but Americans, well, you know, my neighbor, who's a close friend of mine, if he is out of a job because of someone in another country, that is going to make me upset. And he is more important to me than that person halfway across the world that I don't know. I mean, I am biased, obviously, that way because I'm close to my neighbor, but I don't think there's anything wrong with thinking that your neighbor or friend, you would rather them have this single job that's offered than someone else that you don't know. And, I don't think that's nationalistic or prejudice or anything. That's just life, and it's a normal way to think, I believe, but I think the big thing in the end is I would like union jobs. Again, I'm biased. But at least for it to be assembled in America with really good parts from. Thanks, Evan.
All right, Tim. Thank you very much. Kent?
Well, assembly jobs are not very good jobs, unfortunately. So I don't know that if I were to try to, pick off a piece of the manufacturing business that I'd like to keep in the United States, that I'd pick the assembly piece. And your point about you know, having a natural affinity for the people that you know, it is completely natural, and I think we all feel that. I guess my problem, and you know, if you get up to the 30,000 foot level, and you make the conclusion that our people, the people we know, and people who are our neighbors, always matter more than people in other places, I don't find that to be a very good place to be.
Okay, David and Aurora next on the phone. Go ahead, David.
One thing that bothers me is your nomenclature. You're talking about America, but what you really mean is USA. Normally, labels are say made in USA, not made in America. There's Central America, there's South America, there's North America. So that's one clarification that I think should be made. The other thing is some companies really broadcast that. L.L. Bean makes some of their famous mud boots, you know, the rubber lowers and leather uppers, and when they're made in the USA, the label states that, and they even tell you the person who stitched it together, and you can send her a card of thanks. So they capitalize it. They cash in on that, L.L. Bean does.
Yeah, that's a good way to appeal to the sentimentality of consumers, right, Ken?
It's another way to distinguish your product. Yeah, you know, and for people who are willing to pay a little bit more for that, then you know, it could be a good strategy for LLB. But I do think that is to some degree marketing. It's nice marketing. I get a warm, cozy feeling from that too.
Well, let's ask Adam Crandall, who knows a little something about warm, cozy feelings in marketing. You know, what do you want people to think about when they're buying products that, you know, for example, you brought that sparkling water can. So tell me what you're holding. Tell our listeners what you're holding and why you brought that.
So I have an aluminum sparkling water can. And again, some of our actual advanced technical ceramic products go into canning plants that manufacture aluminum cans, whether it's for Pepsi, Coca-Cola, a variety of different food and beverage companies.
And so that's a Wegmans can, right? That happens to be a Wegmans sparkling water, the lime sparkling water there.
Yep. So possibly one of their partners maybe that partners with a canning factory, one of our advanced technical ceramic tools will possibly end up in one of those factories. So it touches everyday Rochesterians as well as Americans.
So you want that warm feeling that says, hey, you know, we are more involved in the products in your life than people probably realize. Yeah?
Exactly. So Refractron plays, that's exactly it, Evan. You summed it up perfectly. Refractron's products play an everyday part in people's lives in Rochester and throughout the United States more than they actually realize. Not only do I like that warm, cozy feeling, but what Kent was mentioning in this caller previously, Tim, it's a perfect example. Some of the actual materials that Refractron brings in, not 100% of them may possibly be all in the United States at all times, but at the end of the day, we have 85 local workers in our factory that is assembling, that's manufacturing, that's actually producing these products. And it goes into these families' paychecks, it goes back into our local community. And in return, I think people should purchase products based on quality, based on value. They shouldn't just look at price, or they shouldn't look at, well, it's going into a family in Sri Lanka, or it's going into a family in America. Look at a product, look at the value, and look what it can do for you. And that's how I think companies should really distinguish themselves, by high-quality type products in a very fast-paced, moving global economy today.
All right, let me grab another phone call. This is John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Yeah, I try to buy American when I can, but sometimes I don't think about it. But when I buy a car, I've been buying new cars since 1974, and I always buy GM. Not that Ford is bad or anything, but I always focus on an American car. Now, I know a lot of their parts aren't made in America.
That's right.
I try to do the best I can. But I got to tell you, one of the few things I disagree with Trump on is his trade policy and tariffs that could result because of his policies. Herbert Hoover, and Kent knows this better than I. Herbert Hoover and FDR, one of their failings in the economy was they put on tremendous amount of tariffs, and that really hurt our economy back and delayed the recovery from the Great Depression. And the other thing is, I think right now, I've done some reading on the issue, and I think right now, as we speak, we have already 11,000 plus tariffs in place on various goods and services in the United States. So I say tariffs are taxes on the consumer and should be reduced as much as possible.
All right, John, thank you. Is that an overbroad statement, or do you agree there, Kent?
I think that's a good way to put it, that if you've got a tariff on an imported good, it means that a consumer is going to pay more for it. So it's almost always true when we're talking about subsidies of one sort or another, subsidies or taxes, that we're moving money around. And, you know, often it's the beneficiary is very obvious. The beneficiary of a requirement that people buy stuff locally may be obvious, and yet the cost of that gets distributed among lots and lots of individuals. You know, it's just not costless. And so the point, I think, is well taken.
Any thoughts on tariffs, Scott? Does that come up in your world?
We're not terrible, at least not at this point. We do see a little bit of increase in price from some, but really it hasn't been bad.
Okay.
So I'm looking forward to it staying that way.
Okay, Adam?
Yeah, so from the global standpoint, Evan, I joined Refractor about a year ago to develop the international segment and take them global. So from what Kent mentioned in this previous caller, tariffs would be a disaster. I mean, tariffs do not benefit at all companies trying to export and trying to participate in a global economy. So I am anti-tariff. Obviously, tariffs are warranted in some industries for protectionism to get certain industries off the ground. From an exporting standpoint, I think it hurts companies. I don't think it plays a positive role in companies that are trying to expand globally. And I remember President Obama, he tried to double exports, I believe, in the end of his term because he knows the benefit to basically what international business can do to a local economy. And that's what companies should be focusing on, is exporting and increasing that playing field in a global economy.
The difficulty with tariffs, too, is that it's very difficult once you've put them on to take them off again. And, you know, you saw this in Latin America in the 1970s, 1980s. They slapped very large tariffs for exactly the reason you mentioned, Adam. Well, let's protect our industries.
Yep.
So that our industries can develop scale. But that never quite happened. And then you're completely dependent on this price differential between
exactly
what you can buy it for from someone outside and what you can actually produce it for individually. So, you know, again, it can be, I think, a productive policy.
Yep.
The difficulty is it's very difficult to wean an industry off of that protected status.
I agree. And I think some of the conversation we've had, Evan, even today, and Kent mentioned it as well, if one country slaps a tariff, how are we going to retaliate? Is it going to be just basically a trade war that develops? And that's not going to be good for our local workers. It's not going to be good for foreign workers in different countries. It's not going to be good for the global economy.
But in the campaign, those were some of the biggest applause lines. The 35-40% tariff, we're going to hammer them.
And that, again, is a major disconnect, I think, in the campaign, and we saw it on both sides. There is a perception that the malaise that we feel, that many, you know, the fact that many people in America do not have the kinds of jobs that they used to have, or they don't have any jobs at all, we're blaming that on globalization. Actually, the truth of the matter is largely these changes have been due to technology, not to globalization at all. And but it does make globalization and foreign trade is an easy whipping boy. It's pretty easy to say we're going to stop it. It's also something that a president actually can change. Congress actually can affect that. You can't affect the pace of technology, but you certainly can slap on a tariff. And so I think it makes candidates feel powerful, and it lends a certain credibility on the stump speech.
Well, New York State Senator Rich Funke wanted to be part of this conversation and could not be here today, but I had a chance to talk to him just for a few minutes because there is a piece of legislation that Senator Funke, Senator Joe Robach, Assemblyman Joe Morelli, there's been bipartisan support for the New York State Buy American Act. And what I wanted to kind of sift through was what it actually is and is not, because sometimes, let's be honest, you see a nice warm feeling headline or a name of, you know, like the Basket of Puppies Foundation, or, you know, like the Everybody Wins legislation, there's no legislation that's called like the Bad for Consumers Act, you know.
Mm,
so
that's right.
I just wanted to know what Senator Funke thought about the New York State Buy American Act and what it is about and why they decided to support it. Let's listen.
Well, first let me thank Senator Robach for advancing this legislation, which had widespread bipartisan support in the Senate and the Assembly. I can't think of anybody who wasn't in favor of this particular piece of legislation. And our Buy American bill requires contracts put out by state agencies to use American-made structural iron and structural steel for all surface, road, and bridge projects over $1 million. And that would start as of next April 1st. Any projects that would come along within the state after April 1st of next year.
And when it comes to the reason behind this legislation, you want to keep as much of the focus on local jobs and the economy as possible? Is that sort of the underlying here?
I think that's right. You know, I think American-made steel and iron is the very best in the world, first of all. So we want, you know, the very best products in the world to be used. The idea, I think, Evan, is not only to protect American jobs in that industry, but to, I think, create a mindset that American-made is good for us. It's about American jobs. It's about the American economy. It's about the pride that comes with being an American and a patriot, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. To get a priority in terms of procurement for whether it's a New York-made product or an American-made product, I think it's important. You know, it's your tax dollars. I think reinvesting them in New York State is a good thing.
We've had some conversations, and we're going to be talking about the global supply chain and how things have changed, how the label made in America or made in the USA used to be a little bit more clear to understand than it is now, just because, you know, for example, in the auto industry, cars that come from Toyota might be 80% made in America now, and cars that have Detroit homes might only be 2 or 10% made in America, depending on supply chains. And that's why in the National Review, conservative writer Kevin Williamson offered a piece titled "Buy American Has Little Meaning in Today's World of Globalized Supply Chains." And he says that it's been studied, that that things have changed so much that it doesn't have any meaning anymore, and that there isn't much of a benefit to buying American because of the way money becomes global anyway. What do you say to that, Rich?
Well, I would ask him to spit that out to an American steel worker or iron worker, first of all. I get it. The world is flat. You know, we live in a global economy, and I don't need a professor teaching Economics 1 to tell me that. We aren't taking foreign products off the shelves. That's one of the things that this bill does not do. Foreign cars aren't going to be banned in New York State. This is simply an effort that when it comes to your tax dollars, building things through state agencies in New York, American-made steel and iron will be prioritized. By the way, the bill also gives agencies the ability to opt out if there happens to be a shortage or if there's some other funding conditions that might exist that might not make it possible. So there are some circuit breakers there. But, you know, you ask me how I can be a free market, common sense Republican conservative and support a bill that's Buy American at the same time, I'd say this. I think the free market can do a lot of good if government would just get out of the way. The problem is, when it comes to global trade over the past couple of decades, we haven't had a true free market or an even playing field. The deck's been stacked against American businesses and jobs, and that hasn't been good for the American workers. So this is one small way that, you know, we can prioritize American steel and American iron and within those projects that the state of New York is advancing that are over $1 million.
All right. So lastly, Senator, you mentioned that circuit breaker. In other words, my understanding is if the cost to use American products, American steel, for example, would be prohibitive, that there is a breaking point that you would say, okay, you don't have to do it this way. From your understanding of it, how often is that circuit breaker going to get invoked?
That's hard to tell, Evan. I don't know. It does contain several circuit breakers that allows for exemptions in what are probably going to be rare cases when it would either be too expensive or too challenging to satisfy the requirement. So, you know, I'm not entirely certain as to how many times that might come up. Hopefully it never comes up. But the other thing to understand in this legislation, Evan, as well, is that this is important. It establishes a work group that will look into how this is going to work, if it's been helpful, whether we should consider expanding state procurement provisions of American-made to other products like concrete, cement, and aluminum, and how we can mitigate any issues with any other countries like our important trading partners to the north in Canada. So if something comes up and it's not working particularly well, we can make adjustments to the legislation.
All right, that's State Senator Rich Funke. And what I want to do, just kind of follow that up so you get a sense for that piece of legislation, is just mention that we always appreciate the senator's time and that our members of government just couldn't be here today on the program just to schedule anything. And I think that's absolutely legit. A lot of people are traveling and a lot going on. So you get a sense for the senator saying, look, he doesn't have any problem defending focusing local, that he thinks there's a patriotic tinge to it, and he's proud of that. The one thing that tripped me up a little bit as I listened back to the interview, Kent Gardner, was the fact that he said if the free market can do some things if government gets out of the way, while touting a program in which the government is telling people how they have to allocate resources.
Well, I'm waiting for the requirement that we should all eat more broccoli, too. I think that that's probably one of the next pieces of that the free market
American
probably
broccoli?
Doesn't do a very definite one, New York broccoli.
New York broccoli.
We should probably be eating Monroe County broccoli.
Well, they're not from Monroe County.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry.
Well, from Monroe County, but work in a different county.
Yeah, but I don't care. I mean, yeah, I don't live in your county.
Exactly.
You know, we should be eating Monroe County broccoli, for heaven's sake.
Why
you
not?
Guys can go eat, you know, broccoli from Wayne County if you like. But
it doesn't sound like you're a fan of this idea.
Well, the cognitive dissonance in that interview with Senator Funky is a little stunning, that he professes to be a free market guy, a free enterprise guy, and yet he wants to require that we use U.S. steel. And again, the question comes down to if we're going to require that New York State purchase only U.S. steel, then that means that the province of Ontario should therefore require that they buy only Canadian steel, and that we should expect that the United Kingdom is only going to buy steel that's produced in the U.K., and on and on and on and on.
And he might say, okay, so what? That they would be, you know, supporting their own countries, and
that's right. And then let's extend it to wheat. Let's extend it to soybeans. Let's extend it to aircraft. I mean, at the end of the day, the whole thing falls apart. I mean, the global trading regime has achieved tremendous improvement in well-being across the world, and I know it's a nice feel-good legislation. As you suggest, this is a nice bit of a basket of warm puppies legislation, and very hard, I think, for someone in Senator Funky's position to vote against it, because he'll have a lot of people in his district who will grumble and say, well, you know, this just isn't fair to local workers. But it's still bad policy.
All right. Well, let me ask the guys from Refract a more general question then. What do you, from your perspective as a company in Wayne County that employs 85 people, what do you see government's role in making sure your company has, you know, what it needs to succeed? You know, I wonder, apart from what you just heard from Senator Funky, how you view sort of that interaction with government, what
yeah,
you want.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think the government currently in today's world, Evan, they need to help support local business again from a global standpoint. So we're trying to export globally. We're trying to get into more international markets. We need to make sure we have a fair playing field. I mean, globally right now, I've been doing traveling in Asia, South America, I mean, all over the world, and interacting with all of these different clients. And sometimes some of these countries do play by different rules. They maybe have less strict regulations, less strict environmental laws. They have these regulations where the American worker sometimes basically can't compete. And we're seeing that sometimes with price. We're seeing that sometimes with tariffs, like Kent mentioned before.
And that's what the president during the campaign said. Well, sure. Well, don't you worry. I've got your back. We're going to hit them with tariffs.
Well,
it sounds like you don't want that.
I hope the government can step in and basically make sure that corporations and small businesses in the local area can at least have a level playing field. The government, I believe, from my standpoint, I'm not a huge throw government in, get them involved, make massive amount of policy. I think the government does need to step out a little bit of the way. But at the same time, they need to be looking at these local communities that do employ these 85 employees in our factory and say, when we're trying to get into Germany, we're trying to get into South Korea, how can we at the same time be as competitive as another country and a different continent that's also trying to export?
Okay. What do you make of that, Ken?
There's an important role for the federal government, particularly in trade. And, you know, there are cases, many, many countries don't play fair. You know, we don't want to play fair. Nobody wants to play fair. I mean, you know, we all want to have an unlevel playing field, but we want it tilted in our direction. And so one of the things that the president could do would be to sit down and have a serious, challenging negotiation with Japan, for example, which has a lot of restrictive rules around trade. There are many, many countries that do have restrictive rules, and we should be negotiating with them to eliminate those. And if you do a little saber rattling on the side and say, well, you know, if you don't bend on this particular provision, we might just take a look at the tariff. We might take a look at some of the other rules that we could apply. So there's an important role for government in trade.
Okay, but not all the way to protectionism is what you're saying.
But yeah, we can have, what we want to do is move towards freer trade. We want to move towards fairer trade. But we certainly want to take efforts so that we do more trading.
Exactly.
Is this why
I always get rolled in negotiations? Because I'm like the one guy who does want a level playing field for everybody, including me. But I'm terrible at this stuff.
So do I. And I think that that's the right thing, but that's not actually...
No, that's not how the world works.
That's not the way the world works. And so I think that we expect the federal government to be muscular in ensuring that the rules that we confront are fair, and they're not always fair.
Yeah, Adam, about 20 seconds. Some final thoughts from you on understanding the global supply chain and what Made in America means. Go ahead.
Again, to me, Made in America is supporting local jobs, supporting American workers, even if you don't have every single component from America, at least the finished product is made in the United States. And right now, we're currently hiring and looking for talented people all the time to join our American workforce so we continue to export products globally and make an impact overseas.
You're online where?
www.refractron.com. You can email me directly at acrandall@refractron.com for further information. By all means, we'd be happy to consider and take a look at opportunities.
Adam and Scott, thanks for being here and sharing your experience. We appreciate that. Nice meeting you guys. Thanks for being here. And Kent Gardner, always good. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
A lot of fun here. Much more connections straight ahead. Stay here.